hello, everybody, to what for your humble interim program director at KPFK is, well, his most anticipated new show of the season, the 2010 KPFK World Cup Soccer Show, titled The People's Game. I am interim program director Alan Minsky here at KPFK, and I'm joined in studio with two of my co-hosts. The show is going to have multiple co-hosts, but two of them are here with me now, Jennifer Doyle, a professor at University of California, Riverside, and Pablo Morales, a filmmaker with a fantastic film we'll hear about shortly called Gringos at the Gate. Welcome to KPFK, Jennifer.
Hi, Alan. Thank you for providing the initiative for getting this wonderful program going, a unique perspective on the global game, the people's game, or the beautiful game, depending on how you're feeling about it in the morning.
I'm an Italian fan. They just take the beauty right out of this thing and win the tournament. And Pablo.
Yeah, hi, Alan. Thanks a lot for this opportunity. It'd be a lot of fun to talk about this sport I love so much.
Well, as you can only imagine out there, folks, and as you no doubt know, the World Cup Soccer Tournament is the largest human spectacle of our time, a unified cultural experience. Really, arguably, the only thing that rivals it and maybe even does surpass it is the general presidential elections in the United States in terms of global attention and global media attention. For those of you who don't know, since, of course, here in the United States, soccer has not been as popular as it is in almost all of the rest of the world, the World Cup soccer tournament far exceeds the Olympics in terms of global attention, human consciousnesses, locked in and following this month-long spectacle. So there is a ton of media about the World Cup, but I think right now you are hearing the opening moments of a very unique project, because this particular project, unlike almost every other project that will be covering the World Cup, is going to, yes, concentrate on the game on the field, but it is also going to concentrate just about in equal measure with the political, cultural, economic, and social subtext of this immense global spectacle. I want to let people know how the show is going to be operating here on KPFK also over the next month and on kpfk.org. The show is going to be on in English and in Spanish once a week, a half an hour each show, Wednesday 8:30 to 9 in English and then 9 to 9:30 in Spanish. Then, once the tournament begins, while it will remain those times on KPFK, it will have a daily podcast. The shows will, of course, be available on the KPFK website, where there will also be a link to a unique website for this particular show where all podcasts will be available. And that unique website will also have a blog where you'll be seeing all of the co-hosts blogging and participating in the dialogue about the show, the content of the show, the tournament, and all those subtexts I mentioned. Now, there are 32 teams in the tournament, and one of the other goals here, since this is, again, an incredible global spectacle in the era of globalization, each team will have unique correspondences, so at least 32 correspondents, one for each team in the tournament, and for many sides, they'll have multiple correspondents. So all of this to be expected on this show titled The People's Game. And I want to talk right now in this opening segment, not just a, we'll get in a second to maybe who Jennifer and Pablo put them on the spot, who they think will win the tournament. But before we get there, maybe talk a little bit about the kind of, again, political and social, cultural, economic subtext that we'll be looking at. After all, this is KPFK's take on the World Cup. Jennifer, why don't you start?
Well, I started my own blog from a left wing because when I wanted a place where I could actually engage with sports writing, and I had actually started pitching some ideas that I had that were basically feminist commentary on the EPL to mainstream blogging sites. And while those articles were taken up and actually welcomed by editors, the context within which they were being read was actually quite brutal. It was a little bit like kind of trying to mount a feminist critique in the middle of a mosh pit in Orange County in the late 80s. it was brutal and not necessarily a very positive experience. And I realized that by creating my own blog, I could create a kind of alternative virtual space for people who are otherwise alienated by mainstream sports media. So, you know, I have a wide range of readers, but they're really interested in getting the kinds of perspectives that mainstream commercially oriented sports media can't accommodate. And there's a lot of people like me out there, other bloggers, writers, artists, filmmakers, who are very actively engaged with sports culture and with this particular sport. We're hoping to actually collate some of those unique voices and represent the very interesting and provocative work they've been doing in their own ways as a kind of counterpressure to the stories that you're going to be hearing on mainstream sports media.
You know, and one of the things, too, again, in taking on the World Cup, there is, of course, the tournament on the field, but there's a global spectacle, there's the global television spectacle. And, of course, in this show, we'll be critiquing so much of that. Pablo, why don't you tell us first a little bit about your movie and then about the kind of, again, subtext that you'll be looking at in the tournament?
Sure. My movie, Gringos at the Gate, comes from a lifetime of being a soccer fan born in the United States of immigrant parents and always feeling a bit like a second-class citizen within the larger mainstream media sporting establishment. Throughout growing up, it always seemed that there were more people with Mexican soccer jerseys in my neighborhoods than the United States. And come 2002, in the second round, when the U.S. actually beat Mexico, there seemed to be a key change. I'm coming about this kind of roundabout, but my film, since that's what you asked about, is about the change to the Mexican nationals and immigrant populations within the United States when they start to lose the dominant soccer team within CONCACAF, and not just losing it, but losing it to the United States, the country that is their arch enemy, as no other country in the Western Hemisphere has an arch enemy like the U.S. is against Mexico, having taken a third of their land, being so socially and economically and politically dominant, and sharing this long border that is so contested through immigration and the demographic change within the United States. There's multiple levels of conflict going on, and every year, at least once, sometimes twice, the national teams play, and for 90 minutes, that clash, culture clash, happens. And for one population, for 150 million people, it is a dagger in their heart when they lose, and for the other 150 million, most of them could care less. And that is where my film comes from, that difference.
Yeah, it is something else, because one of the things that will be looked at in this show, of course, is the relationship between the teams in this tournament and nationalism. Of course, very much versus internationalism, or just being a fan of the sport, as it were, in the tournament, because there is an incredible just explosion of nationalist fervor around these soccer clubs. And one of the things that stands out is it is a particular variant of American, by American I mean the United States of America, exceptionalism, because there is so much less passion. It is not the national sport. It is arguably maybe surpassed hockey for fourth, but maybe golf has bumped it back into fifth. I mean, it's somewhere in there as a spectacle sport. And yet again, such an odd relationship this country has to soccer. It's the number one sport played by youth. And because women's soccer is so well organized in the United States, and organized unlike in other countries, there are now more youth soccer players playing organized soccer in the United States than any country in the world. And so therein lies the capacity to have a very strong national team be developed, great players, but it's compared to the rest of the world,
a
void.
I might push against that a little bit and push you a little further. And so far as I think one of the things that Pablo's films helps us to see, or helps those who sort of don't participate in soccer culture locally, you know, is the way to which the Latino adult population in the region and in the U.S. nationally is erased, right? When we talk about soccer, when we produce this narrative of where it fits in terms of as a successful television spectacle, right? That ranking of soccer as the fourth or fifth most popular sport is based, I believe, on television audiences. Mm-hmm. And there are other ways of measuring the power and the size of sports culture, or any subculture really, than it's in the degrees to which it gets integrated into commercial media. Mm-hmm. So I think when we start looking at things from other angles, we see soccer, for example, in the Southwest as by far the most popular sport by nearly any standard with which you would measure that, right? Setting aside, for example, perhaps the television audiences for NFL and from NBA games.
And commercial revenue generated because, yeah. I mean, again, the non-English language television stations, I mean, boy, so often, you know, I go through the market in my neighborhood and it's a soccer game on at midday with people transfixed watching it.
Absolutely. You know? Once they started incorporating the Nielsen ratings for Spanish media, radio, and television, they found that within the metropolitan Los Angeles region, the number one weekly sports shows are the Mexican soccer games, completely not on the map. And in a lot of ways, the so-called mainstream Anglo media has deferred or just given it up to the La Opinions in newspaper or the or the KVEAs and the local radio, television, and said, okay, well, you guys do this, you do it well, it's in your language, it'll be your sport. And it's really not their sport. If you go to any community outside of the central downtown Los Angeles, every single community has a thriving youth soccer, but it's just not in the mainstream media.
And of course, locally, in terms of, say, the Los Angeles Times, which in English language media remains the sort of regional behemoth, the World Cup will start. Mexico will play the opening game. USA will play their largest game, arguably, in the history of the team in England in the opening match, and will be competing against the Lakers.
Yeah. Oh, you're kidding me.
Yes, the Lakers against the Celtics. So it'll be interesting to talk to Graham Jones and the folks over at the Times and see how that plays out. I mean, of course, the Lakers will have their own subsection, but the World Cup will probably have its own subsection, but maybe not until the Lakers are done. That's my prediction, but we'll find out from the people at the Times. Now, one of the things I want to talk about, too, maybe heading back to Jennifer here, which is that one of the general cultural discourses in the world, and certainly in Hollywood and in Los Angeles, are issues around the construction of contemporary male identity or gender identity. Mm. And certainly, global soccer and the World Cup and sports culture in general speaks volumes about constructions of male identity and female identity.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that over the course of this show that I get to talk about the many different facets of this issue when it comes to soccer for women players, women as spectators. But with the World Cup, one of the things that sort of caught my interest very recently, where you see the kind of the misery, right, of the situation of the female spectator of an event like the World Cup, was Nike's ad. It's called Write the Future. It's a campaign advertising the World Cup in which celebrity players are filmed in the middle of a kind of fantasy of a game in the current World Cup, and playing out in their minds what's going to happen if they manage to successfully, you know, block a shot, or, you know, if they score a goal. And it's a 3.5-minute extravaganza filmed by the noted Mexican director Iñárritu. And in it, there are massive crowd scenes, right? There are scenes of people playing, trying out moves executed by players in the match. And there are very, very few glimpses of women anywhere on the screen. You have to actually freeze frame, you know, do a screenshot of the ad and blow it up on your computer and scan crowd scenes to see if you can find any women. The women that are visible are in bespangled hot pants, little sex objects, or, and this is the worst thing, and this is, I should say, from Nike, you know, hardly something I look to for models of, you know, ethical conduct in any matter, but they are the corporate sponsor for the U.S. women's national team. And there's a section in this ad where it's the only section where you see women trying to play soccer, and they're in short shorts, kind of tightish shirts, and it's a girl who tries to do a Ronaldinho-inspired sort of step-over move. She steps on the ball, and she falls over, and everyone laughs because, oh, it's so funny when girls try to play soccer. And then the title of this, it's actually like a YouTube, a video that's imagined on YouTube, and it's called Women's Soccer. Right. And so, and that's basically the mainstream attitude that's reproduced within sports media. I hate to say it, like by a network like ESPN. They may, on the one hand, do some great work in terms of their partnership with Global Girl Media, but on the other hand, they do the biggest sports story in women's sports, arguably, was their broadcast of the Elizabeth Lambert ponytail pulling incident of some bad conduct at a tertiary, if that, college match that, if it were men, it wouldn't catch anyone's attention as newsworthy, but it gets cast as a girl's behaving badly. Huge story in sports media last year. So this is the kind of thing that I'm hoping to be kind of looking for in the World Cup and to be kind of a cranky feminist.
Yeah, I was going to say, because that piece of video, which I have to admit I watched several times, the fact that she was a girl soccer player is secondary to the fact that that was a horrendous foul and kind of brutal. If she had been a lacrosse player, a field hockey player, or anything else, I think it would probably still have been as interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think it had everything to do with her being a woman, though.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, violence in sport with women, that is still something that's not readily acceptable.
Well, and just for my own self, too.
We should point out I'm actually in a broken arm as we're talking about this, an arm that was broken in a soccer match against a local team called the Divas.
Ah, there we go. battle wounds, indeed. And now I know KPFK listeners out there are a little bit perhaps more familiar with myself, so I'll be succinct. but I am certainly going to be looking for the subtext of how this relates to the global financial crisis. As I said, the World Cup soccer tournament is the largest global spectacle whenever it rolls around every 4 years. This one bigger than ever. And of course, we're in the midst of this massive financial crisis. And I'm sure people know that once the games on the field are off, they know this from American sports, the pages are filled with a lot about finance and the finance of players and of teams. Well, this is playing out so writ large in soccer. And again, what does it mean to have this spectacle at this moment in the history of global capitalism, this moment of crisis? How does this play? How does this play to the masses? What sense of reassurance does it provide towards the state of the global economy? And where are the fault lines and the cracks in it right now? If you follow global sports, you may know, for instance, the Texas Rangers in baseball are filing for bankruptcy. Two of the greatest clubs in the world, Liverpool and Manchester United, and many others are in crisis. There's also this relationship of the core versus the periphery in terms of the dominance of the top European leagues. And I know that in some of the smaller countries in the world, their soccer leagues are in severe financial crisis, and the question of whether the A-leagues in some of these smaller countries in Europe and around the world can actually maintain their global soccer cultures. And the same is true also, of course, of women's soccer.
I might point to, for example, a country like India, not a small country, but a country in which soccer is very popular. And like here, it's a kind of tertiary sport, a minor sport, in which the people who are advocating for the sport are really struggling with the question of the popularity of EPL broadcasts, of broadcasts of European soccer, which are so entertaining, so highly produced, and such a high quality and such a wonderful level of play. The pleasures of consuming them far exceed the pleasures of attending local matches.
Right.
And so people have really worried about the draining of audiences for live, you know, live audiences for local sides and support for local sides in the national game as the consumer product, right, of European football, of the English game, grows and grows and grows in popularity. And so very similar questions are raised in relationship to the United States.
Yeah, well, Clarence Seedorf, actually, when AC Milan was playing yesterday against Chicago Fire, was asked in a press conference, did he feel like the Dutch team suffers because their best players play in Italy and in England and in Spain? And how does that relate to the United States, that we're seem to be exporting our best players? And his response was very interesting. He said, well, Holland is a small country. We can never compete with the bigger countries. It's better that our players go and get the best possible playing experience because that only benefits our national side. But the United States, he inferred, I can't say he said this word for word, is a big country. And if they ever got their act together, wouldn't need to export their players. But at this point, they need to. So I don't know how that plays out. But.
Well, and also this is something true that you'll get to there. Now, as I just said, in terms of the relationship of the global financial crisis in soccer, I don't also want to shy away from the critique of sports as distraction. We'll be talking about this at times. I've already spoken to a few prominent leftist theorists, and basically they did make that point. So while I love the game and I love the game on the field, it's a tension point as to those of you who are listening right now who maybe feel that way about sports, how is it then that this isn't distraction from the larger political and cultural and economic issues of our time?
The most controversial point that I've made on my blog, which provoked sort of the most, hate mail, was a point that in which I'd kind of waxed romantic about the side of the game which can't be, to use the vocabulary of global capital, monetized. And I'd suggested that, in fact, perhaps in the U.S. we should do a little less hand-wringing about our failure to match the EPL, the English Premier League, Premiership, and rather celebrate the aspects of the game which have failed to kind of organize into those kinds of capitalist entities, the fact that we have been less successfully capitalized, right, that we have this kind of decentralized network of independent leagues that, you know, make no one anything, right, except happy. That side of the local soccer game is something that we should celebrate as perhaps a more sustainable model of a sports culture. And suggesting that to people who are fans of the MLS,
well,
who like basically called me, you know, a crazy communist. So
I think that actually
it's not so far off the mark.
No, that I think that'll always exist, though, that you know, subculture of soccer. And you have that in every country, though. I mean, in every corner of the world, you can find kids playing on the street who never have a hope of playing professionally. It's but when you do talk about the capitalistic soccer world that is most prominently displayed in the EPL, where clubs are spending millions and millions of dollars for players who sometimes don't even play because of injury. And then you look at the enjoyment that the game gives to everybody on the street. Mm. They're just two different worlds. I don't think you can ever say that one is going to ever equate to the other. Mm. But it would be nice if we celebrated it, like you say, more than we do.
One thing I always think about when I think about soccer is I grew up a little bit in England and a little bit more in Italy and mostly in the United States. But growing up in England and Italy, I was very conscious of soccer as a real cornerstone of working class culture. And into the 90s and into this decade, that element of global soccer seems so much to have fallen away from being a primary mode of how it's conceived, especially spectacle soccer. In England, it's very noted that it went from being a very much a working class spectacle, and now it's this sort of big money thing, especially at the EPL, the English Premier League, the top league in England. And I'm wondering, as we look at the World Cup, do we still see signs of working class solidarity? Of course, this is going to be so much an issue in terms of the African teams. How do they do in the first tournament ever in Africa? Or does all of this, both class and national conflicts, core versus periphery, working class culture versus high-end capital spectacle culture, is all of it pushed down into subtext? And does it even exist as subtext as anything that can be discerned?
I think it's less now, only because if you look at the creation of most sports, you see it as all came from this colonial British fake creation that it was okay for the middle class to participate in sports. It wasn't something that existed anywhere else. And where it spread in the world is where the railroad men from England and the miners from Wales would go. Soccer teams would spring up. And when you talked about India, for example, and it is a tertiary sport, it's because the Indians are a very class-oriented society, I believe. This is my opinion. And they wanted to participate in the sport that the upper class participated in, which would be cricket. And if they could afford ponies, probably polo. Whereas the working class isn't seen as something worthwhile, or it's not good to be part of the working class, therefore soccer is not looked upon very well. And now I think as what happened with the English Premier League, what they did is they basically saw the money that can be created from this quote-unquote working class sport and elevated it to something more than working class. Yeah. And that's something that the globalization and mass media that we have can do. It can transform that.
It's sort of like the absorption, appropriation, and incorporation of working class masculinity into a product that gets sold to the middle class. Right. It's a, you know, I'm thinking, for example, England is a great, you know, sort of case study for this. And so far as you have what was a deeply masculine, deeply working class environment and culture, which has then been turned into a product that the middle class consumes. There's still a romance with working class masculinity. Wayne Rooney being perhaps one of the most fantastic poster childs, right, or whatever poster figures
right.
for that.
Right.
And, you know, so I think that the romance with working class masculinity is absolutely still at the core of what is perhaps no longer available, right, to actual members of the working class. But then, of course, the working class itself doesn't look like what that romance, that romantic fantasy of the working class looks like, right? It's less white, for example, mm-hmm. in England mm-hmm. and here, for example. I mean, the tensions here around soccer, class, ethnicity, and nationality
and
are
education.
Very unique and complex. It's one of the reasons why Pablo's film is so compelling, because it finds through soccer this fantastic and very economical, efficient way of accessing some of the densest issues that are operating in U.S. national politics right now with regards to U.S. national identity, shifts in class, empowerment, the disenfranchisement of working people in this country. So,
well, and certainly, of course, these play out both player by player across the World Cup, and they also play out against teams. I mean, certainly Argentina versus Brazil, and there's, you know, clear lines of political demarcation that much of the world reads as subtext, which probably never really gets expressed by the mainstream journalists. By the way, at the British midfield, you have quite a class contrast between Steven Gerrard and Frank Lampard, Lampard being one of the better educated, more middle-class players. Gerrard, for an American audience, you pretty much need subtitles to understand him when he speaks, very much from a working-class background. So these things play out, and having been in England in recent years, this is very much recognized by still the British audience in terms of which players people respond to. So all of these things will be stuff we'll be talking about again across this show. But now let's get back to one other element that we have to do before the time runs out on this particular segment, which is, Jennifer, you look at the tournament maybe two aspects to this for all three of us. Which side are we pulling for, and which side, as we look at, do we think will take the tournament?
Well, I'm going to ignore the latter because I think there's plenty of people who have more sort of well-informed opinions about who they think can actually do it. And I don't think that anything I have to say is really going to forward that. I am going to respond as a writer and say there are two teams that I would love to see go as far, you know, as right up to the finals. One would be Argentina because it would just be an impossibly delicious story, given Maradona's character, the difficulty that every footballing association seems to have in wrangling that man. I want to see him.
You want to see him run naked through the streets of Buenos Aires.
Absolutely, yes. And then the other would be the Ivory Coast. And I would, you know, of course, it'd be a great story to see an African team do so well. Drogba is a fantastic player to watch, and I think I've always found him compelling just as a character on the field, his personality, his beauty. So, of course,
he made a huge political intervention into the civil war in Ivory Coast, playing, by all measures, apparently, a significant role in helping along the ceasefire.
That's right. Mm-hmm. He's definitely stepped up in acting as a mediator when no one else can do it.
Go ahead, Pablo.
Well, you know, my whole life I've been a fan of the United States soccer, even when the World Cup qualifier in 1969 for the 70 World Cup in Mexico. My dad and I went down to El Camino College to watch them play the World Cup qualifier against El Salvador. There must have been 3,000 maximum in that little stadium, of which 300 of us weren't wearing blue and white. And we assume we must have been for the United States because we really weren't, you know, waving flags or anything. And I just love to see how far our national team has come. Yeah. In a short amount of time compared to the rest of the world. And I just also love it when, for example, last World Cup, when I interviewed an English fan, and he just, all he had to do was conceptualize what will happen if the United States ever really does get good at soccer, and then that'll be it as far as he was concerned. That's what we do with everything. As Ricardo Peláez, we interviewed for my film, forward for the Mexican national side, said, well, you know, the North Americans, the minute they grab onto something, they just hold on to it till they control it. Mm. And I understand, therefore, as someone who's always cheered for an underdog, i.e. the United States, well, how I'll probably end up changing my tune once they do get to that point, but I still root for them to get there. In terms of who will actually win, there's the rational side of me that believes that Brazil always has a decent chance, always when it's not in Europe. The best European sides are going to be, in my opinion, Spain and Holland, and not just because my mom is Dutch. And so, I mean, but I'm not someone who would ever really put money on a team because I think that would ruin the joy of it. I want the best playing side come July to be winning the whole thing. You know, that's where I am as a fan. I just want the best playing side.
Well, for myself, 2006 was a source of just never-ending joy. Grew up, as I mentioned, partly in Italy, and they won in 2006. I had tremendous affection for that team. I have a very hard time wishing well upon the Italian team. Berlusconi's political party is named after the national soccer chant. Long tradition of right-wingers exploiting the success of the national team. No country has done that more than Italy. They won two World Cups under Mussolini. So I have a hard time rooting for them. It's going to be a test of how deeply ingrained this irrational partisanship is in with me, because when I see the Azzurri out in the field, I hate to admit it, but I no doubt will root for them. And I don't like the team. My favorite player was left off, and I loathe Berlusconi with all of my heart. Not that the center left in Italy is all that much better at this hour. What teams do I think will win the tournament? I do think Spain is very strong. I dare say it. Brazil would probably be the team that I pick, and it's a default choice. There are other teams I'd really rather see win simply because they're the default choice. And I never have been able really to root for them. I understand that Chile is a very beautiful and underappreciated team. So people, if you want to see some pretty soccer, apparently watch the Chilean team.
Absolutely.
And as for a dark horse, I think it's England. I think they have great advantages with the weather, and I think they have great advantages because it's an English language country that they're playing in South Africa.
And they have an Italian coach.
Yes, they can squeeze the victory out of teams in ways they haven't.
They've been playing the ugly game lately.
Yes, they have.
Yes, and I would not be surprised if you have a little uptick on the London FTSE exchange in about a little over a month's time. Jennifer Doyle and Pablo Morales, thank you so much for joining us here for the inaugural show of The People's Game. Thank you.